Next up on This Week in Law, our guest Keith Lee is a lawyer, blogger, author, and creator of Lawyer Slack, among other things. Mike Keyes is here with me as well. We're going to talk about what's happened between last show and this show with the travel ban and what may happen coming up, what you can expect. We're going to talk about assaulting via Twitter. This is something that has happened and a legal theory that we think is interesting, and we're going to explore some more. We're going to talk about civility on social media in general, lawyers gone good and bad, the ACLU dash button, and legal AI, ready for prime time or not. All this and more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, and Mike Keyes. Episode 376, recorded February 10th, 2017. Assault with a Deadly Tweet. Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We're so excited to be with you here this week. It is Friday, February 10th, as we record, and there has been much going on in the last week since we did the show with Ben Weisner of the ACLU and talked a lot about the travel ban. We're going to talk a bit about the travel ban more this week since, as I said, much has been unfolding in the few hours after we concluded the show last week. The travel ban was stayed. So, and that stayed was just confirmed yesterday, or affirmed, by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. So we'll talk a bit about that. And we have much, much more on deck for you. As folks have been noticing, the internet has been becoming a wild and woolly place, even more so than usual lately, as people plant their flags and have their political discussions, hopefully in a civil way, but oftentimes not. Someone who has paid attention to some of the developments on that front and is a well-known legal blogger and a lawyer in Birmingham, Alabama, is Keith Lee, and he is our guest this week. Welcome to the show, Keith.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Keith practices with Hamer Law. Am I saying that right?
Yep.
And he's the author of The Marble and the Sculptor, a book about transitioning from law school to law practice. So it's great to see you.
Good to be here.
My co-host Emery Roan is off for the week studying for the bar and otherwise being busy. But never fear, Mike Keyes is here. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Denise. Great to be here today with you and with Keith as well. Really excited about the show.
I'm excited about it, too. Great to see you again. Mike, of course, is a partner at the Dorsey & Whitney firm in Seattle, Washington, and one of the many contributors to their wonderful IP law blog, which is called The TMCA, which is a great place to learn about Dr. Seuss and other things. Actually, I'm being facetious. Really great place to understand what's going on in the world of IP law. You guys do a great job with that blog. I'm really impressed that your firm actively contributes to it so much and supports it.
Yeah, thanks. We have a lot of fun with it. It's a great project. Keeps us all on our toes and hopefully up to speed on a lot of the legal developments that we see in the IP space.
Definitely. And you help keep the rest of us up to speed as well. We're going to help keep you up to speed. If you could tear yourself away from Facebook and the TV and all the other ways you've been getting your news about the travel ban, we'll start off the show talking a bit about it as well. It's probably healthy to get people off their social media platforms thinking about things like this, as we'll discuss later in this show when we talk about trolling and harassment on those platforms. But in the meantime, so just to recap, in a very, very brief abbreviated form, because I know you folks have already been well apprised of what's been going on, but last Friday, a temporary restraining order went into effect. intervening days involved briefing and oral argument before the Ninth Circuit, before a law and motion panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, where many, many people, probably, I've got to think, I haven't seen anybody, you know, make a pronouncement on this, but I've got to think that has to have been the most people watching a law and motion oral argument ever. Hundreds of thousands of people at least were watching this. You screenshotted something, Keith, where there were close to 200,000 people watching on YouTube at the time, mm-hmm. and just, you know, dryly opined on Twitter. That's a lot of people listening to a motion hearing. Do you agree with me that that's probably got to be a record breaker?
Yeah, it probably does. I mean, motion hearings are maybe actually the most exciting thing you're probably ever going to do as a lawyer. Like, the rest of the time you're just doing homework, and a hearing is actually where something's exciting happening, but it's still incredibly dull. So to have that many people come on and, you know, show interest and be that concerned about something, I mean, it definitely shows that A, people are really concerned about the issue, and then B, I think it's a good sign for transparency in the court system and the fact that that is now available due to technology, the fact that people can listen in to hearings and what's going on. I think that's a valuable thing for citizens to understand what's happening in the law.
Yeah. It is neat to see the court system effectively using technology that way. And it was very cool to note that because the court system used technology that way, the mainstream media were able to pick it up and cover it in real time as well. So you could either watch in real time yourself, or you could tune into many, many TV outlets and watch there. So even the 100,000 viewer number, that's an underestimate of how many people were actually watching in real time. And of course, even if you didn't watch in real time, you heard all about it in great detail from the people who did. So the outcome of that, it took the court a couple of days to sit with that. And I think it was really educational for a lot of people to see how the appellate process works. It's not the most well-known part of our judicial system. People tend to think about juries and trials and jury four people reading a verdict and that's the end of the process, but it's not. We have various levels of review. That's just, you know, sort of the starting gate of the legal process oftentimes. People got to see that play out, and they got to see how federal appellate judges and many state appellate judges and justices handle their work. The whole appellate process is about probing the parameters of an argument, maybe not tipping your hand necessarily as a judge as to how you're leaning. And this is true, particularly, it's probably most people are familiar with it from watching Supreme Court oral argument or listening to it. If they're watching it, they may be watching it with dogs inserted as the people actually speaking, as something that we've highlighted as a resource on the show is I forget exactly what it's called, but it's like a dogs playing poker version of Supreme Court oral argument. But they do make the audio of those arguments available. And you can see that the judges ask lots of probing questions. They try and get the lawyers in the cases to explore the limits of their arguments, you know, the ramifications. If we do this, counsel, what's going to happen? You know, what are we getting ourselves into here? And it's really important when you're in that situation as a lawyer to answer the court's question. Even if the court is getting to make you trying to get you to make a concession that might damage your argument, this is not the place to deflect or try and answer a different question than the one that was posed to you. These judges want you to answer the question that they asked. And I think we saw some examples of that not going so well for the Justice Department's lawyer in this particular hearing. And we saw examples too of judges jumping in when, you know, they knew that the lawyer had an answer, a good answer to the question that was posed to them, but wasn't giving it. And the judge jumping in and sort of asking them a leading question to get them to remember, that's what you're getting at. So it was, I think, just having people see that process was an interesting and new and useful thing. And then the result of that process was the judges sat with the arguments that they had heard and the briefing they had received and issued a, I guess it's a 29-page opinion yesterday, laying out their reasoning in detail and point by point and upholding for now this temporary restraining order in the Washington case. So the ball is back in the Justice Department's court to decide, no pun intended, to decide what they're going to do next. But if they don't do anything, or if they do some things and they don't get any different result, there's going to be a trial, or at least, you know, the next process is the process that runs up to a trial in the state of Washington. You guys think I missed anything there?
No, I don't, but I'd like to comment on one other aspect of this whole process. And I've got to say personally, this whole thing has made me really proud of the legal profession and particularly the justice system. Now, you can either love or hate or be somewhere in between those two extremes with respect to the court's decision here, but it's pretty remarkable what's happened in this last week. On Friday night, Judge Robart here in Seattle issued his decision. That was immediately appealed. I think it was either on Saturday or Sunday. The court held oral argument on Tuesday, and by Thursday we had this 30-page opinion, very detailed, very you can disagree with the court's analysis all you like, but you know, it was a well-reasoned decision, and it just, to me, it underscores how important the judicial process is to the democratic system and how serious all these people take their jobs. I mean, it was so obvious that the judges involved in the panel had studied up very quickly, were very familiar with a lot of the precedent that was controlling or otherwise persuasive. And my hats are off to the two advocates that argued both for the federal government and on behalf of the states. I thought, you know, under the time constraints and the pressure associated with this whole endeavor, I thought they both did a tremendous job. So, again, like or hate the decision, the process works, and I think we should all be really proud of how well it worked, even if you disagree with the decision.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Mike. And again, back to my educating the country point, I don't necessarily think that a lot of people and maybe a lot of people in the executive branch had a good grasp on how our court system functions and what trial judges are authorized to do and how something winds up getting before the Supreme Court ultimately in a conventional way. It starts with a decision of a trial judge, and that's what we see unfolding here. Anything else to add, Keith?
No, I mean, I would just agree. I mean, I think it was a really interesting occurrence just to have that many people pay attention, because it's one of those things, regular, you know, lawyers grill people in their job, but appellate lawyers get grilled, right? It's a sort of a flip of the normal thing. People think about lawyers going into depositions, asking questions, cross-examining witnesses. Well, that kind of gets reversed in an appellate situation. Suddenly the lawyer is the one who's on defense, justifying their points, emphasizing certain aspects of their argument, but mostly just asking the judges questions. So to see that play out and sort of help people understand that, like, oh no, it's not law and order. There's this other aspect that goes on in the legal system about actually where law proceeds to make case law, the appellate courts, how all that occurs, was definitely a nice to be highlighted in a way. And I think, like you said, a lot of people were like, oh, that's how this works. Probably even some people in the executive branch were like, oh, maybe the new people.
Right. We mentioned last week, just to tie this into the usual technology focus of our show, that over nearly 100 tech-related firms have thrown in behind the state of Washington here. Some of them are directly involved, and should this case get to trial, will be part of the evidentiary process in demonstrating how not being able to have their workers travel freely is detrimental to their economic interests. Just an update, since we did the show last week, that had already happened last week, that these folks had thrown in, but a new group of startups and VCs have joined that legal fight as well. Anything, since you're on the ground there in Seattle, Mike, that you can add to this?
Well, should we talk a little bit maybe about the procedure from here on out, and some of the possible outcomes? So I guess first and foremost, it's important to emphasize, as many people probably realize, this was not a decision on the merits. This case is not over by a long shot. This was a review of what's called a temporary restraining order by the trial court. And so the appellate court's review is not considering all the facts and evidence that may be developed at trial, but it was simply just a review of Judge Robart's decision. So this case isn't over. What happens now, I think there's probably two procedural avenues that could be pursued. The federal government could ask the full Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals for what's called en banc review, which is asking the entire Ninth Circuit to look at this decision anew. This decision that came out of the Ninth Circuit yesterday was from a three-judge panel. And so the federal government can petition or ask the full court to take a look at it. And I think there's maybe 11 judges that would be involved in that process if the court accepts en banc review. Very uncommon for a federal appellate court to rehear a case en banc. I think the chances of a case getting heard by the U.S. Supreme Court, you have a better chance of the U.S. Supreme Court accepting your case than getting a federal court to rehear a case en banc. But
yeah, especially when it was 3-0 like this.
Yeah, very, very true. Very true. So, and also, this isn't a decision on the merits. It's really more in the form of a procedural type of review than anything else. So I'm not sure that the arguments would be all that persuasive for the full court to review. So the other possibility, of course, would be for the federal government to petition the United States Supreme Court to hear the case. I don't know the propriety or whether the likelihood is high as to whether the Supreme Court will hear it. But even if the court were to accept it and were to consider the case, remember, we've only got 8 justices on the U.S. Supreme Court, and it's pretty evenly divided along ideological fault lines. You've got 4 quote-unquote liberal justices and 4 quote-unquote conservative justices. And if they split on this case, if it ended up being 4-4, the Ninth Circuit decision would be upheld. So that's another avenue that the federal government could pursue. The final one would be, it'll be back before Judge Robart here in Seattle, and it will proceed toward a full decision on the merits, and then the appellate process starts again anew once the full and the more fulsome decision by the court is entered. So those are kind of the procedural aspects of what's going on here.
And of course, as it goes to trial, what happens there is the parties do discovery and take evidence from one another. So we'll see some probing of, on the one hand, what the damage is, what the harm is from having the travel ban in place. And on the other hand, we'll see some probing of what the harm is for having it not in place. And I think that latter question will be important in, should the Supreme Court be asked to intervene early? I'm really, the only way I see them doing that is if they think, there's some great national threat that they need to put a stop to.
Right.
And of course, they're very reluctant. Maybe this isn't an of course for everyone, but they're very reluctant to get involved in a case that hasn't been fully fleshed out yet. trial judges have their job to do to make these, they're sort of the gatekeepers on the way to the Supreme Court, and they're supposed to make these determinations and have a trial and flesh everything out. And one of the questions that came up a lot at the argument just a couple days ago was, you know, is this in the record? Do we have a record? What does the record look like? The record is all the stuff that the parties investigate and put in front of the court under oath, whether it's testimony in court, whether it's deposition testimony, whether it's answers to written discovery, all that stuff comprises, okay, these are the facts that we have in this case, and this is what we have to analyze when we apply the law. So right now, there's very little of that. Some declarations were filed in support of the TRO. And I guess, Mike, we should talk about the next step. A temporary restraining order is sort of emergency relief. But the next step in further shoring that up is to get a preliminary injunction in place, which is a less temporary form of relief. It's in place until there's a trial, and it would only stay become a permanent injunction if the party who got it wins. So do you see any different outcome when they do get to the preliminary injunction stage of this? There could be.
Absolutely. It's a really good question. I mean, as I understand it, this was a TRO, temporary restraining order, as you said, Denise, is really kind of an extreme remedy that is provided right on the spot by a federal court. Now, typically a TRO is entered for a short amount of time, 14 days, and then the court is to consider it in the context of a preliminary injunction, which would last during the pendency of the case. So it is possible, if this goes back to Judge Robart as opposed to some of the other appellate avenues we discussed, that the federal government will present additional evidence. As I understand it from reading, from hearing the oral argument and then reading the court's opinion, it looks like the federal government essentially took the position that when it comes to immigration decisions made by the President of the United States, they're effectively and essentially non-reviewable because the President has that much sweeping authority to implement policy when it comes to immigration. The Ninth Circuit clearly rejected that proposition and not only said that decisions by the executive branch are reviewable by courts, it went the extra step and said, and you didn't provide us with any evidence or you didn't provide the trial court with any evidence as to why this ban was absolutely necessary and why we should rule in your favor right now. That's the Ninth Circuit speaking. So, you know, it's probably going to be looked at anew by the federal government. They're going to assess whether they really should be considering providing additional evidence as to why this travel ban was necessary and so on and so forth. So we'll have to see what's going to happen. It's going to be very fascinating to see this play out.
It will. And other states, I don't remember off the top of my head which ones they are now, but other states are filing their own similar lawsuits, seeing the way the wind has blown here. So I know that Missouri joined with Washington. I suppose it would make the most procedural sense for them to, if they all have similar interests, to sort of join together. But I don't know that we'll see that happen. They probably don't all have similar interests that they'd be able to put in front of a court. So it'll be interesting to see what happens on that front too. Keith, anything else?
No, I think that's about it. I mean, it's, you know, at this point in time, it's like a lot of stuff with court that most people sort of forget the fact that this all just takes a long time. There's a process. Mm-hmm. This was actually pretty fast, realistically, because it was all such an emergency situation. But now this is going to be a slow, long process where people start to realize, okay, well, how are we going to go procedurally? Which way do they go? And whatever they choose, it's just going to take a long time. I mean, there's no getting around it. So it's kind of a wait and see moment for everyone.
Right. Okay, I'm just checking in IRC to see if there are any urgent questions there before we shift gears. Virgil's talking about how Tim Cook condemned the immigration order in a Glasgow speech. If we stand and say nothing, it's as if we're agreeing. So more on the tech titan front and their take on, I mean, certainly all industries have an interest in making sure that their employees can freely travel around and that they can bring in the talent that they need from where they need to bring it in. But the technology industry is uniquely in that situation. And I think we're going to see that fleshed out in more detail in the evidence in this case. Virgil asks, does the court take into account the travel ban is affecting business owners, professors, teachers, families? Yeah, I mean, that's certainly what's being argued here is the fact that anybody who has the ability, whether you're the business itself or you're the individual, that the impact is palpable and damaging. Here the thing, and it was a bit of a hurdle for them to get over at this preliminary stage, is showing that it's the state that was damaged, that it's not these individual people, the professors and teachers and the businesses themselves, who should be suing. And it seems like both Judge Robarts and the Ninth Circuit panel were comfortable, especially because of the way this case was positioned with the universities so front and center as an arm of the state, that yes, they certainly have been damaged already and are in the position to have quite a lot of damage if this continues in place. So what also happened last weekend on a lighter note was the Super Bowl. And on the tech front, the tech law and regulation front, you probably are wondering what about the Super Bowl triggered anything on the tech and law and regulation front until you're thinking about the halftime show. I hope you didn't skip the halftime show. It was my personal favorite part of the game, although the last 6 minutes were a close second. The halftime show involved this series of drones lit up in formation behind Lady Gaga. And of course, I was watching this on an airplane, actually. And the first thing I thought of as I saw all these little drones on the tiny screen on the plane in front of me was, how did the FAA let that happen? Because our story for last year's Super Bowl was the 32-mile radius around the stadium in San Francisco where no one could fly a drone. I think not just during the game, but for a long time before it as well. Here, what apparently happened was they got special dispensation from the FAA to do this, and they did it before the actual game. So those drones were nowhere near the stadium when it happened, and they somehow cobbled together a way to make it look like they were all behind Gaga and then staged her jump from the top in as though the drones were there then. So did you guys also marvel at the drones and then furiously Google how they pulled it off? How about you, Keith?
No, I saw it. And yeah, it seemed like that probably isn't happening live. It just doesn't seem like they're actually going to let that many drones accumulate over the space, and just in case any type of errors could happen, and who knows what would actually go on. But I mean, it looked cool. I mean, it's I think it's probably a preview of things to come. I, you know, 15 years down the line, I fully expect to look up in the sky and see a drone on a very regular basis. So, I mean, why not go for it? Use it for a halftime show.
What was your thought, Mike, when you saw this, or did you even watch the Super Bowl?
No, I absolutely did watch it. It was a great halftime show. Loved the drones. I also loved, of course, the 360 degree keyboard that was featured by the keyboardist for Lady Gaga. It was great. Great show.
Absolutely. Yes. Let's talk about that a little later on in the show, because I had some thoughts about that as well. One other drone thing just to note. Speaking of lawsuits that start out in lowly trial court but have the capacity to have a broader impact, there's a law in a Boston suburb that takes the FAA's already pretty difficult to comply with drone regulations a step further and only allows drone flights if the property owners have agreed. So even if you complied with, you know, you got your registration with the FAA and you paid your fees and you weren't flying within 5 miles of an airport and all the other hoops that you have to jump through, you weren't flying over roads or people, you'd still, in this place in Boston, have to get the permission of the local property owners before you could fly your drone. That just pushed one doctor in the area too far, and he filed a lawsuit. He's taking on his ordinance in Newtown, which was passed last December, which bans UASs, small unmanned aerial systems, over private property at or below 400 feet without the owner's permission. And he's going to argue in this suit where he's representing himself, never a good sign, I don't know actually what he's going to argue. He probably doesn't know what he's going to argue because he's representing himself. But I suspect that what he might argue is that it's in conflict with the FAA federal regulations, which should prevail here and prevent this broader local regulation from taking hold. And I suspect that this won't be the first of these lawsuits that we see, because certainly every city and county and unincorporated association around the country has their own take on how drones should fly over their airspace. So I wouldn't be surprised to see more restrictive stuff go into place and people decide to challenge that if it's really, you know, I mean, already the FAA stuff is a lot to work through and manage. Any thoughts on this, Keith?
I mean, it's one of those things. It's like, okay, sure, come up with all the regulations you want. I mean, if you're in a dense urban environment where there's a police force or whoever is actually going to be the one enforcing this to go around tracking drones on a regular basis, where there's a city-based environment where there's hopefully the money and the density in which it's easy to keep track with this, okay, maybe that'll happen. But to try and say that you're going to go out and somehow enforce this in rural America in smaller towns where, you know, I mean, people are already strapped for cash, I mean, to me, it just doesn't matter. I mean, go ahead, pass all the regulations you want. All right, I've got a drone, especially as the connections get better and the radio frequencies get better, the battery gets better. You can have drones that stay up for, you know, hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, and that can have a much larger range of distance for operating. I mean, all right, I'm going to sit in a parking lot, fly it somewhere it's not supposed to be, and fly it back. What are you really going to do about it? I mean, it's the cat's out of the bag in a lot of ways to me. So, you know, it's not something that concerns me too much. I mean, again, I think there'll be a tighter control in more densely populated environments. But, you know, you get out into the country and forget it. People are just going to do whatever they want. And the people do that right now. I mean, right. You know, so
we are.
I don't think it's make that much of a difference.
We are seeing this strange juxtaposition of what people actually do with drones and how they are supposed to fly those drones. And those two things are diverging more and more as we speak. Mike, anything to add to this?
Yeah, in terms of the doctor's suit, I mean, I haven't read the complaint, but as I understand it, he's alleging a violation of his First and 14th Amendment rights. Mm-hmm. So I'm not exactly sure that you have a First Amendment right with respect to drone flights. I'm not, and maybe some religious ceremony of some sort that he's engaged in, and he's claiming it to, you know.
Maybe he's engaged in journalism.
Well, that right. could be. That could be. Yeah. I mean, that mm-hmm. he's engaged in some sort of news reporting function or, yes, fact gathering. I suppose he could claim that there's First Amendment right associated there with that endeavor. 14th Amendment, I'm not sure what he's alleging there, if this is a violation of his due process rights. It strikes me that maybe a bit more persuasive argument might be that, look, there would be some sort of federal supremacy here because the FAA has endorsed use of drones at the federal level so long as you meet certain criteria, and that should trump any state or city or county ordinance that tries to restrict my ability to operate a drone under federal law. So I don't know. We'll see. But the First and 14th Amendment did strike me as a little bit curious in this context.
Right. Hey, Mike, I don't know if you remember the show where we talked about how long it was taking for FOIA requests to be complied with, and some FOIA requests that had been filed 20 years prior or 20 plus years prior had just been responded to and the documents were now available. That seems like a good segue to the next story, which we're just bringing to people's attention in case they missed it in the crush of other news in the last few weeks. And it has to do with the FBI and how it takes its Freedom of Information Act requests in. It used to take them in several ways, including by email. Email to a portal that has consistently shown problems itself, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not going to take them by email to that portal anymore. Do you remember what a fax machine is?
Yeah, I was about to say it's fax. They're going back to the fax machine. Forget emails. Yeah, forget emails. Forget an online access portal. Forget any type of, you know, modern 20th century conveniences for submitting information. They're taking it back all the way to using a fax machine in order for FOIA requests, which is really just saying stop sending them to us. We don't want to see those anymore. That's the actual message the FBI is sending to everybody with this.
Right. I remember the last time the fax machine came up on our show, I found a Creative Commons image of one languishing sadly next to a building having been abandoned, and probably people walking by and wondering what it was. But this seems like an odd step to take and a good juxtaposition, I guess, to our discussion about courts helping people have access to information by technology. I guess you can't always rely on the government to take steps that are forward ones. We're back to the facts as far as FOIA requests to the FBI. So dust off your fax machine. Make sure you have one. Certainly if you are a journalistic exploratory outlet who hopes to get information through FOIA requests, jump on eBay and make sure you are technologically equipped. Anything to add, Mike?
No, I don't think so.
I think, are we going to get some more like Office Space montages of people with fax machines? You know? Yes. I mean, like, it's so dumb. I mean, it's purely a we don't want these anymore move.
Right. It is pretty funny. You know, I'm sure the FBI has some stated reason why they think that they should receive their requests via fax. I'd love to, maybe I'll dig it up after the show and see if we can provide it to you next time. There we go. Thank you, Victor. No, don't do it. We need it for our FOIA requests. Awesome. All right, moving on. We have people kicking and taking out their aggressions. What a wonderful segue to the social web. Keith, I'm so glad that you decided to follow and go deep on the story that we're about to discuss, because it hadn't come to my attention. It happened last fall, and it started last fall, and it's so interesting. And I'm really glad it caught your eye and that you wrote it up at your wonderful blog, The Associate's Mind. It has to do with a journalist. What is his name again?
Kurt Eichenwald.
Who does he write for? And before we get into this in detail and talk about all, you know, what happened to him, et cetera, what did he write that triggered this, that kicked it off?
Kurt right now, or Eichenwald, writes for, I believe, Newsweek currently at the moment. Mm-hmm. And he is a very left-leaning journalist and was a very
vehemently anti-Trump and took very anti-Trump positions in all his writing, which, you know, obviously anyone who paid attention online in the past few months, you know, it was a very, let's say, caustic environment on social media in the past few months regarding the election. Mm-hmm. And because Eichenwald was very present, he has a very active Twitter account and tweets often, he attracted the attention and ire of Trump supporters who, and I guess the alt-right sort of group people, and or the new right, whatever they want to identify as. And as that happened, it just brought him a lot of negative attention, and which resulted in the current situation.
So these facts, and we still haven't told you what they are yet. I promise we will. But my other take on this whole saga unfolding is I'm sure that law professors are already, you know, taking furious notes, and this has probably already been incorporated into somebody's tort exam somewhere, because it smacks just of all the cases that you're taught in law school where your head wants to explode because you can't really imagine a court having to sort through all of these details and come to a conclusion. It seems like, oh, this could never happen, and but it does, and the courts have to make law based on this. So the wild card fact here that we haven't told you yet about Kurt Eichenwald is that he is an epileptic, and I guess a very publicly known epileptic. This is a thing known about him. So when things started getting bitter and nasty on Twitter, someone decided to try and harm him by sending him an animated GIF of flashing images of the kind that can trigger an epileptic seizure. The first time this happened, it was bad news. It was mean, but no, he didn't suffer any personal harm. Is that right, Keith?
Right. Yeah. So it happened one time. So how it came out is Eichenwald's a very well-known epileptic, and then people started to send him, there's actually a term, I'm going to butcher it, it's epileptogenic, I believe, style image, which is just an image flashing, strobing that causes epilepsy. And he got it the first time, but it was to the side. He didn't really, it didn't bother him in a certain fashion. And it was not a big deal. And then he wrote a story about it, actually, like, oh, you know, people are actually trying to harm me. And then about a month later, so he alleges that he was at home and received a message from a Twitter user that was one of these style images with the really bright strobing and flashing. And across the image, it said, also stated, you deserve a seizure. And so he got it. He said it caused him to have a seizure. And he was laid out for a little bit. His wife immediately jumped on to his Twitter account like an hour or two later and said, oh, this happened. And then the next day, Eichenwald got on and
tweeted right to the guy who did it and said, yep, this is his wife. You caused a seizure. I have your information and have called the police to report the assault. So, Keith, you've had a series of three posts about this now. And in response to one of them, someone enlightened you, and you in turn have enlightened me, and I'm sure others, that it is possible for someone to die of an epileptic seizure. So we're not just talking about inconveniencing or hurting someone. We're talking about potentially killing them.
Yeah, it was brought to my attention actually by something, maybe if we have time, we'll talk about later. Another lawyer in my Slack group brought up the fact that, oh, actually, you know, some epileptics, depending upon the severity of this type of seizures they receive and how it happens, there are essentially like sudden death occurrences that happen from seizures. And it can, you know, cause really serious injury for people. So for Eichenwald, you know, he said he's all in. He filed the complaint with the police department, and then he also filed a civil suit. You know, and the issue here was, of course, the Twitter user who sent him the offending tweet was obviously anonymous. And there was going to be a big fight. You know, they filed a special type of pre-litigation filing to do discovery regarding Twitter to say, all right, well, you know, we want to try and find out who this guy is. And Twitter accepted service and said, we'll agree to expedited service, which was really interesting because generally speaking, Twitter has always been very good about protecting the rights and anonymity of its users. Mm-hmm. And in this situation, they might have agreed to expedited service just in order to go ahead and get on with it, but they said they weren't objecting to it. They'll agree to expedited service, go ahead and get it to us, and we'll respond to your written depositions and let's just go. So that was a little unusual. But then the anonymous Twitter user made a special John Doe appearance and said, okay, no, you know, this, you don't actually have the correct jurisdiction over me. This is incorrect. It's not the right court jurisdiction to come and get me. And everything was proceeding along, and they were set to have a hearing on it. And then out of the blue, Eichenwald's attorneys filed another motion saying, we're done, actually. We know who this guy is. Don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where we're at right now, is nothing's happened. That's been about 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks at this point, since Eichenwald last filed that motion, or his attorneys filed that motion, stating the fact that, okay, you know, we know who this guy is. We don't need to go to Twitter anymore. We mm-hmm. found out who this guy is.
We've unmasked him. Which
yeah,
means
which
they
is
are,
like how?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's my big question is how, you know, they said we're going to have to go through this whole process to figure him out. And then they said, oh no, we're done. Don't worry about it. I mean,
mm-hmm. it could be any number of ways, right? They could have hired a private investigator who was pretty good. They could have, started canvassing all this person's followers or people mm-hmm. they were following and seeing sure. if someone would rat them out. And apparently one way or another, they figured out who it was. I mean, they seem fairly confident from what you're saying that they know who and where the person is. And so, as you said, there's a civil suit and the police are involved. So whatever local police would have to be brought in to
sure.
actually, as you said in one of your posts, this transforms from sending someone, you know, the fact that you're not allowed to assault people, certainly not deadly assault people. It changes something from sending someone a flashing GIF on the internet to the FBI knocking at your door. So
right. Yeah. It's a little different. You know, the thing is with the criminal suit, I mean, where Eichenwald lives and initially filed both the criminal and where he made his criminal complaint and then also filed the civil suit was in Dallas. So mm-hmm. he filed the complaint with the Dallas Police Department. Then it's up obviously to the discretion of the prosecutors of the Dallas County, whether or not to pursue it. You know, my thought was, I don't really see a Dallas prosecutor being like, wait, what happened? No, I got time. We've got other stuff. We've got real crimes. You know, I'm not inclined to think any type of criminal proceedings are really going to go anywhere. You know, if it's going to happen, it's going to be on Eichenwald's own dime, him trying to pursue a civil suit, tracking this guy down, which he, again, says he has this guy's information, whether he got it through a PI or through, you know, online investigation. However he got his information, I feel like that's probably the only way he has any legs on this. Cause I just feel like a prosecutor is not going to be very sympathetic considering everything else they have to do, everything else that's on their plate on a day to day basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unfortunately I tend to agree with you there. And I think our friend of the show, Mark Randazza, was of that opinion too, right? You had an exchange with him about the speech issues involved here and what's likely to happen.
Yeah, I spoke with Mark. Mark's another guy in the Slack group that we'll talk about later. But yeah, we went back and forth and we talked about it some. And yeah, he was the same opinion. You know, to what you said earlier, his thought was like, law school, absolutely, this happens. If this is on an exam, absolutely, this is textbook assault, and this very, you know, it ticks off the elements. It's the type of thing that if you were a law student in law school and you were to answer this as on an exam question, you would answer as an assault, and he would win. In the real world, are you going to convince a jury? What are Eichenwald's damages? Is the first big question. Okay, you had a seizure, and you were inconvenienced for a little bit in the evening, and maybe it startled you, and you had to lay down. But then, you know, he was back to tweeting the next morning. How did it affect him in some way? Like, what are you going to go to a jury with to say that I deserve, you know, X amount of dollars for the inconvenience of this? I just don't see that, like, there's a lot of money there. You know, the real thing that my speculation was, but Eichenwald hasn't done it yet, was he did all this to dox the guy, to unmask the anonymous Twitter user and just roast him in public, be like, look what this guy did. But he hasn't done that yet. So, you know, who knows what's going to happen.
Right. Yeah, that'll be interesting to follow along with. I suspect if he doesn't do what you just suggested, maybe just filed the lawsuit in order to expose and shame the guy publicly. I suspect he'd be able to cobble together a damages argument. You know, maybe there was medical care involved, at least temporary loss of ability to work. You know, it wouldn't have to be much.
Right. Yeah.
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 Just enough to support the lawsuit.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he could get something together, but it's not something like he's going to get a lot of money out of it or anything like that. I mean, if he really is into it and wants to pursue it, I would imagine it's more on he's doing it for the principle of the thing, to be like, look, this is a good chance for me to go in and demonstrate a bad situation, and there's an ability to make some case law and to show people online that, like, hey, this type of behavior has consequences, right? It's like, oh, it's not all fun and games on Twitter where you can go on and just, you know, harass people nonstop.
Right.
Some people are going to fight back.
I wonder if some of the case law they could bring in is developing not out of intentional acts like this, where you're actually coming after someone and trying to harm them. But all of the instances I sort of anecdotally hear about, where whether you're at a concert or someone's watching TV, that there's some sort of epileptic seizure triggering event that accidentally transpires and seizures ensue. And I'm sure there are lawsuits that result from those kinds of events as well, that start to develop a notion of a standard of care of what you need to do to look at whatever technology you're using. You need to be conscious of the fact that you may be able to trigger someone's epileptic seizure. I've certainly seen warnings at concerts and other things that this performance involves strobing lights and seizures are possible. So I know that there's got to be a standard that's developed out there. The other thing you write about in the course of, you know, documenting procedurally what's going on here is the doctrine of assumption of risk, which I think would be really interesting to play out there. Can you explain that for our listeners and viewers?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's no assumption of risk in an assault situation. Like, if there's certain times where you're engaged in certain activity where, as an individual, you assume the risk of, say, I'm going to go whitewater rafting on level 5 rapids, right? There, I am assuming the risk if I go along with a whitewater rafting tour and they're going to take me along these very dangerous rapids. I'm going to sign waivers and I'm going to get knowledge of the fact that I'm assuming the risk of going into the situation. I wasn't somehow surprised by I wasn't walking along and the sidewalk fell out from under me and they were class 5 rapids. I assumed the risk. I voluntarily went to that situation. And so, yeah, some people were like, oh, well, you know, he should have known better by going on Twitter. There should have been whatever. Well, I mean, no, he's not assuming the risk there's no assumption of risk in assault, right? If you're minding your own business and then someone just assaults you out of the blue, which is this situation, or wouldn't matter if we were in person and somebody came in here right now and just hit me with a baseball bat, there's no assumption of risk by, I need to watch out that some guy might come into my office and hit me with a baseball bat. Like, that doesn't make sense. That's not a real thing. So if it does get classified as assault, there won't be an assumption of risk at play for Eichenwald. Mm-hmm. Although common sense is I'm going to be online. I'm using my computer. I'm aware that there's obviously video, flashing images. Twitter has the functionality where media will not autoplay. You can go into your settings and say, hey, right here, I want to, off. And that way you have to actually, you know, click and make sure video or images, GIFs, let's not get into that argument, will play. And so is, you know, common sense wise, if you're an epileptic, you should probably take some precautions. But legally speaking, no, there's no assumption of risk in assault. So I don't think that'll actually come to play if it goes in and gets classified as I think it will be as an assault charge and not a freedom of speech issue.
Right. In IRC, Virgil is asking about assumption of risk and noting that the whole ski industry would not exist without that doctrine. You know, you've mentioned rafting, but if someone falls on a ski slope, they've definitely assumed the risk in that in most instances, they wouldn't be able to sue the ski resort. But who they would be able to sue is the person who skied by, decided they didn't like their look and whacked him with a ski pole.
Exactly.
that would definitely be the difference. Mike, what are your thoughts on all this?
Yeah, so Keith, I had a question about your point about if this were a law school exam, absolutely, you know, you'd write that this would be an offense that you could be prosecuted for. You think in the real world, it's just not sexy enough. It's just too questionable whether you can assault over Twitter. Why do you think there's such a chasm between law school and reality here?
Because A, it's a matter of first impression, and then B, judges are not the most tech savvy of people, and juries as well. And I mean, it just sounds far-fetched. I mean, the idea that you're going to reach through a computer screen and cause someone else physical harm, you know, that's science fiction stuff. Oh, I'm going to, you know, hack you or whatever and do stuff and cause you injury. Right. You know, it seems a little far-fetched, far afield. And I just wonder about actively persuading a jury or persuading, in a criminal sense, a prosecutor to go after people for that. I mean, from a legal dork standpoint, it's sexy as hell, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, wow, this is really different. That, you know, wait, what? This is a very novel instance of assault. Sure, mm-hmm. Let's get into that. That's what attracted my interest, you know. It was super interesting. Mm-hmm. But is that compelling to a jury? Is it compelling to a judge? Is it compelling to a prosecutor? You know, I don't know. I mean, I think Eichenwald's correct. I mean, I think this, like I said in my post, I think this is definitely a sort of textbook example of assault, just in a very new and novel way. It's okay. Just a matter of, can you convince a judge? Can you convince a jury to actually go along with you? And I think that's just an uphill battle. And part of it because of the damages aspect, and then part of explaining the issues at hand through technology and why it fits the elements of an assault.
Now, for a criminal complaint, though, you wouldn't have to show damages, right?
No.
That would just be in the context of a civil suit where you'd have to show you were somehow damaged.
Yep.
But yeah, for a criminal prosecution, you know, I guess assaults and attempted assaults happen all the time, and there's not necessarily any damage that you could show for it. But here it seems like the guy, even if you had to show some sort of harm or damage that was inflicted, he's able to say, look, it did cause me to have a seizure.
Sure. No. And I mean, on that front, you know, again, all this initially took place, and where the criminal complaint was filed, because where Eichenwald lives is in Texas. And I spoke to some Texas lawyers in and around Dallas, and I was like, hey, do you think the Dallas prosecutor's office would go after this? And they were all like,
yeah.
Right. And so, you know, I mean, it's Texas. Come on. Like, they're like, what, some journalist got his feelings hurt because someone sent him an image? Nuh-uh. That ain't happening. Yeah. You know, and so
geographically, I agree with you, and temporally, I agree with you that police departments aren't equipped or positioned or of a mindset, I think probably really anywhere in the United States at this point, or I don't know about globally, but to be approached with a case like this and decide they're going to investigate it and have the district attorney prosecute it. But I would footnote that and say, watch this space, because police departments are starting to have divisions and investigators who are solely focused on cyberbullying and harassment and, you know, threats that come in a digital form in some way. I still think that it's not to the point where a lot of those things are run down and prosecuted, but they're starting to have the resources and the mindset to do more with that. So this actually, I think, would be a really interesting test case for a police department, maybe not in Dallas, because this wasn't just someone getting their feelings hurt. This was somebody subjected to something life-threatening that came at them through Twitter. I don't know. I mean, they haven't, as far as you know, nobody's closed off the notion of prosecuting, have they?
No. I mean, you know, the last I heard about it was, you know, he filed the complaint and the Dallas Police Department just said it's under review. And that's been the extent of it. So whether it's something they pursue or it's just in limbo, which happens a lot of times when you file police complaints, you know, it kind of just goes into the police department and is never heard from again. So we'll see down the road if anything comes of it. But right now it's all quiet from the Dallas side.
Right. Well, as long as we're on the topic of the Wild West of social media, Twitter has taken some steps this week that I don't think would have helped Mr. Eichenwald, unfortunately, but they are trying to make Twitter a nicer place to be, have announced some changes in how search will work, some prioritization of search that will hopefully present you with search results that are more relevant and put things that are potentially abusive or low quality at the bottom of the list, or perhaps not even accessible unless you jump through certain other hoops. What else is interesting that they've done here? They've taken two other steps that I'm not really remembering right now. Mike, do you remember what they were?
I don't recall specifically.
Let me glance through this.
I mean, from what I remember of it is that they're taking the time to use, you know, obviously they have tons of data and they're just using algorithms and machine learning to scan interactions and look for and flag users that have caustic replies on a consistent basis and they're going to start devaluing replies. So if some reason a single tweet gets lots of retweets or it gets popular and gets lots of likes and there's starting to be lots of replies, they're going to start, as opposed to just showing a natural timeline of the tweets in descending order, they're going to go in and start analyzing these tweets and say, you know what, this one is actually really bad and we're putting it all the way to the bottom of the list and hiding it. So they're trying to, so just like you get, you know, maybe you've missed this on Twitter when you log in and it shows, you know, things that it thinks you might be interested in, they're going to apply that same type of filter and algorithm to replies to popular tweets or replies to your own tweets. And so that way, if the Twitter system thinks that you're negative or violating their terms of service in some way, they'll just automatically put you at the bottom of the list.
Right. The other things aside from just putting certain things at the bottom of the list, there are certain things they're not going to show you at all that won't show up in a normal search, which they're calling potentially sensitive content. And they're also going to make it so that your searches ignore messages from people who you've blocked or muted. And then the final thing is trying to address their whack-a-mole problem, where people get suspended and then just come back and form another account. They're going to start asking for phone numbers in order to reinstate accounts. That seems like it's going to be difficult, but the Washington Post points out that phone numbers are at least somewhat more difficult to obtain than an email address. So we'll see how all that goes, but it doesn't seem like any of that would keep you from getting a flashing GIF. So maybe they can, maybe, you know, they're filtering. It seems like, you know, if I'm Twitter and I'm approaching my job in their law department the way you would for a television media outlet, I'm thinking about maybe taking steps to make sure that flashing GIFs are flagged and that I'm not incurring liability for the company by not protecting users from what happened here. Mike, what do you think about that?
It's an interesting observation, I guess.
All right. Where shall we go next? Let's go to, before we stop talking about trolling altogether, let's delve into the world of virtual reality and realize that if social media, you know, is sort of this long established place where people can say and do bad things to each other, VR is truly the Wild West. And unsurprisingly, I guess, but yet sadly, there are already episodes and problems that are unfolding in the world of VR. In particular, Ars Technica has a piece by Annalee Newitz that's talking about the game Rec Room, which is half game, half social space for Vive and Oculus, where harassment is not uncommon. It's sort of, again, you know, you wonder what constitutes harassment in a virtual world. People have reported being sexually harassed in this game, groped by another player. Again, you know, this is something that's happening to your avatar in a game, or do you actually, no, you're not like in a full body suit, so I don't think you can actually feel it. But just some interesting ways in which harassment can get creative and maybe things you haven't thought of will be developing from the world of VR. And again, these companies' legal departments are going to be on the front lines of developing terms of service and community standards of what's going to be okay and what's not going to be okay in a virtual world. They already have steps in place where you can, and this is described as a series of incredibly complicated steps you can take to ghost another player, which involves shutting out the offender for the length of your play session. You have to re-ghost them again the next time you log in. You can also lower players' voices and also report people for violations of Rec Room's code of conduct. So they at least are, you know, addressing that people are having problems with abuse in this game. It's a pretty sad state of affairs that one of the first things you have to do when you're innovating in a new space is figure out how to make people behave civilly to each other, but it's just a fact of life. Any thoughts about this, Keith?
I don't buy it. I mean, I'm sorry. It's like, all right, you put on a VR headset and then someone came, they groped me. They cyber groped me. It's like, no, they didn't. You're full of crap. That's not a real thing.
But it will be, right? It's just because the technology's not good enough yet. There will be a time when all of your senses and all of your, you know, surface neurons will be engaged in your virtual reality experience.
I guess if I got a full body haptic suit on in which I can receive stimulus input and then someone could come up and theoretically, I guess, grab you in some way. Mm-hmm. But even then, you're self-selecting the
you've self-selected to put on a haptic suit, and then you're also going to go through and agree that you're going to receive, you know.
Ah, but we were just discussing input. There's no assumption of risk for assault.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. I just don't get it. I mean, like, that's not a thing. I guess, you know, if I go into it, I mean, again, this is so theoretical. I mean, it's so far out there to the idea that, I mean, I think there are some haptic suits right now that some people are using. And then if you get the full, like, omnidirectional, like, omniball systems, in which where you're wearing an Oculus, you're on essentially a 360-degree rotational platform. So when you walk in space and you can have full movement right. in a virtual reality environment. Mm-hmm. So if you combine that with a haptic suit and did everything, I guess you could have a situation in which someone could assault, you know, they could punch you in some way and it could cause you to fall down and hurt yourself and hurt your head. I mean, yes, theoretically it's possible, but in its current state, no, you're lying. You're making it up. It's imagination. It's not real. No.
But you do have to plan ahead if you're one of these companies. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, I agree with Keith. This seems like a bit of a one-off at this point, but maybe in the future, who knows? Maybe there will mm-hmm. be, you know, prosecutorial courts in virtual reality at some point, and we'll have to deal with this. Who knows?
You're going to go to court in Second Life. We're bringing yeah. back the fax machine. We're bringing back Second Life. That yeah. is the proper jurisdiction for your VR assault claim.
I actually did that. I was at Stanford Law's Codex, you know, their big sort of law conference and computational law conference last year. And one yes. of the things they did is they had built out, they gave everybody who attended, they had built out a courtroom in VR and gave everyone a Google Cardboard for their phones and said, oh, look, you know, in the future, we'll build out virtual courtrooms and have courts there. So I've actually seen and done that there. So we'll see.
Right.
Well, I mean, I guess carrying this all the way to its logical conclusion, if we are going to set up prosecutorial courts in Second Life or other virtual realities, I mean, I guess your avatar would be in prison. You wouldn't yourself, right?
Yes.
It can't be.
Correct. I saw some on Reddit yesterday. Somebody made a big point, the fact that, like, what you do online is actually you're not responsible for it because it's a fictional character that you've created. So you're actually not responding, you know, that's the fictional character is doing the things online and you're separate. You know, I think they were taking that argument and they were going to go to Admiralty Court because they were a sovereign citizen.
Everyone's Stephen Colbert alter ego
yeah.
is who they are online. All right. We are going to put our first MCLE passphrase into the show. We put these phrases in case you are a lawyer or other professional and you like to listen to or watch the show for professional credit in your field. For more information about that, go to wiki.twit.tv. Find our This Week in Law page there. And for lawyers, unfortunately, we are not an approved provider. If anyone would like to partner up with This Week in Law and throw your already existing approved provider status our way, we'd love to talk with you about that. But it's just not practical for us to go through that process in all 50 of the United States and pay all the fees that are involved with that and get vetted by each and every one of those jurisdictions. But we still put these phrases into the show because you can do that all on your own. You can apply to your own jurisdiction, fill out a form that you watch or listen to a show that you think should qualify for credit, and you can let your jurisdiction decide whether or not they agree. It's only in California, it's only $25 to submit one of those forms. So we do this for anyone who just wants to go that route. MCLE is pretty expensive. It's usually a lot more than $25, and it's necessary. It's required for lawyers. So if this is a regular part of your media diet, we do this for you just to give you the option. And we put these phrases in case your jurisdiction is one where you have to demonstrate that you actually watched or listened to the show. Virtually groped is going to be our first passphrase for the show. We'll put another one in before we wrap things up today. And we've already been talking about some criminal acts like assault, so let's talk about a couple of other crimes. right. This one gets the lawyer facepalm of the week. This is the sad tale of a partner at one of the United States' biggest and most prestigious white shoe law firms. White shoe means the people there make more money than we're likely to see in our lives. This is a partner at Akin Gump. He was arrested while wearing a disguise and trying to sell documents that were part of a sealed lawsuit. The FBI stung him and got him. His name was Jeffrey Wirtgen. He hoped to get $310,000 by selling these documents in the sealed lawsuit. And so... you know, I mean, obviously, scandal ruins his life, ruins his family's life. He is free for the time being on a $750,000 bond pending his trial. So you're wondering how leaks happen and what kinds of things can happen. This is the kind of thing that can happen to your sealed and or confidential information, even at some of the biggest, most established, highest priced law firms in the land. Mike, what did you think of all this?
Well, I think it's a real tragic story for so many reasons, obviously. I mean, you got this fella that was... I think he was with the DOJ. He was a trial attorney with the DOJ, joined Akin Gump, as you mentioned, a very prestigious, well-known law firm, and apparently used his connections or his prior contacts. I'm not saying he was in cahoots with anybody, but used his prior position as a DOJ lawyer to have information with respect to this sealed complaint, and then tried to use that in a very illegal, unethical way to leverage a big payout from this company. I mean, it just I read a story like this, and I'm mystified about how somebody who no doubt is a smart lawyer that worked for the government could get himself into this situation. I mean, it's a combination of obviously not thinking it through, being unethical, and just it's flat out crazy. I mean, the guy contacted I'm not sure if it was a random employee at this company, but simply made contact over the phone saying, hey, I've got this sealed complaint, and if you pay me, I'll give it to you, something to that effect. It's mind-boggling, quite frankly, that anybody would do such a thing and do it in such an overt kind of way that could so easily be sussed out, and you could be found out. I mean, it's just, I don't know.
Was taking some anonymity precautions. Asked to be paid in Bitcoin. Yeah. I hate to bring it up this week of all weeks, because lawyers are just, you know, managing to sort of salvage their reputation in our country and be some people who are respected and applauded for doing good work. And I'm afraid there are still some bad eggs out there, and this is an example of one. But he did get caught. Keith, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the idea that any lawyer would do this, let alone someone who's a partner at Akin Gump, which is like a well-known, well-thought-of law firm. I mean, and for him to be a lawyer there, I mean, dude makes over $300,000 a year anyway. I mean, yeah. It's not like it's one thing if you're going to do this, you're going to ask for all right, so A, ethical violation is bad, but if you're going to do this, I mean, you need to be asking for like $300 million and then take the hit to your license, lose your job, whatever. $300,000 just doesn't make sense. I mean, the general consensus from everyone I talk to is the guys, I mean, really, total speculation, but drug problem, gambling problem. That's it's one of those two. Like the guy just straight up had some not public facing debts that he could like get a loan for that, you know, he was underwater and owed a bookie some money, and it had to happen today. And so he just did what he thought was the easiest, fastest way for him to get some money.
Yeah, so, that you know,
seems like a reasonable guess.
Another thing that struck me is, Denise, as you mentioned, it was $300,000 initially, and then he upped it to $310,000, the additional $10,000 to cover his travel expenses from the from the East Coast. So maybe he was like building in, you know, billable hours for that time as well. So I don't know.
And the 10 grand travel is pretty funny. You know, the travel expenses seem a little inflated.
Yeah, that's some lavish traveling for somebody that does a lot of traveling across the country. You know, $10,000 can get you pretty far.
It can. And just to drive home that, you know, not only was this person as a partner at Aiken Gemp, and I have no idea, you know, at what level of partnership he would have been, but he's making well over $310,000 a year. That's what their associates, maybe their most junior associates are paid. So he's, you know, definitely up in the multiple millions as far as whatever his partner draw is.
Yeah, I would imagine. I mean, it sounds like he came over in 2016 from the DOJ. So no doubt he would have been recruited for his, you know, vast experience with handling DOJ matters. So, yeah, I would imagine he's very well compensated.
Yes, indeed. So just wanted to flag that for you all. But something a little bit more fun in the wake of and as a follow up to our last week's episode with Ben Weisner of the ACLU. Many of you have probably already seen, but for those of you who have not, there is a hack of the Amazon Dash button that will, if you know, rather than sending any sort of vitriolic tweet or other message via social media to someone you disagree with online over politics these days, if you think that the ACLU is out there doing good work, you can take what used to be your Amazon Dash button, smack it whenever you'd like, and whenever you take your aggressions out by doing that, it's going to donate $5 to the ACLU, which seems useful in all kinds of ways. But I put it in our rundown today under our, you know, crimes and justice topic, because I just thought, again, you know, my mind tends to go to how can we pull out the really interesting details of these applications and think about them from the standpoint of there being of legal interest, that hacking an Amazon Dash button is fraught with a little bit of legal peril under the DMCA and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And there's no inkling that any of that is coming to bear here, but it's something you have to think about if you're going to be someone who comes up with the lovely ACLU Amazon Dash button. Do you agree with me, Mike?
Oh, I would imagine there's a potential DMCA violation here for sure. Recall that the DMCA, if there's access control measures that are put in place to protect a work that's protected under copyright and you bypass those access control measures, that is a violation of our copyright laws and you can get all sorts of penalties imposed against you. So yeah, I would imagine if there's some copyrightable content on here in terms of software code of some sort, which I would imagine there probably is, and if there's access control measures that protect it, you would have had to bypass those, I would imagine, in order to make this an ACLU dash button.
Mm-hmm. This is written, this is actually a piece that Nathan Pryor wrote up and created this button. He is a 41-year-old project manager, software project manager in Vancouver, Washington. He talks a bit about whether you could easily alter this to donate to other organizations. He says it depends on your threshold of easy. This one is coded specifically for the ACLU donation form. Seemingly, you could redo it for another charity, but you would need to look at the source code for their donation page and change the name of the fields, etc. So that's not really the end that could be problematic for you legally. I'm sure the charities would have no problem with you manipulating their source code to facilitate their getting more money, but it's Amazon who might ultimately take umbrage or be concerned about unauthorized uses of the dash button. Keith, anything you want to add?
No, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think it's just, you know, I mean, it's a neat hack. Sure, it's fine, but it probably is not probably. It's definitely in violation of whatever terms of service that Amazon, that you agree to when you bought it from Amazon. You're definitely negating that and potentially causing yourself a headache down the road. But nice promo for the ACLU. Hey, everybody likes them a lot right now. How much money they just raised this past weekend? $20 million.
Yeah, a lot.
You know, they were doing good work this weekend, but, you know, they're also savvy and they were striking while the iron's hot. And this is kind of part of that. Be like, hey, look at us. Give us your cash dollars. We take it. You know?
Yes. They're doing even better than an average partner at Akin Gump, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to the world of devices we can talk to and hopefully get some use out of. We've done some shows, and I'm sure we'll do some more about the role of AI and the law and how AI might make it so that you don't need to hire an Akin Gump partner who might have side issues that you're unaware of and can perhaps go to some sort of automated, user-friendly, cheaper avenue of resolving your legal dispute. But Keith, I think like sexual assault in virtual reality, you think the future of AI lawyers has a ways to go. Am I right?
Yes. You know,
tell us about your experience.
Well, you know, and I don't want to hate on AI because I know a lot of people at AI research companies, I know the guys at Ross, the people at Kira who are actually doing good work, good systems that are actually legitimately applying natural language processing and certain innovative research skills to certain aspects of law. Cool. That is all good. What I take umbrage with that a lot of people seem to be, especially the legal press a lot of times, because they're don't vet things properly and they just like to get excited to talk about stuff or whatever. Someone will come out and be like, oh, we built this robot lawyer thing and that's going to solve problems. I'm going to do all this stuff. And really all it is like the most bare bones chatbot following a decision tree formula that existed in the 80s. Except now you're going to call it AI and give it some cool name and say it's helping people solve problems. And there was one in the UK recently. A couple months ago and it was like chatbot, lawbot, I can't even remember the name.
Yes, for parking tickets and then again for landlord-tenant disputes in New York, I believe. Yes, we have had its creator on the show.
Yeah, that one is doing something real. That one is again, but it's the same sort of thing. It's not actually AI and it's not a robot. It's just it's a very well-coded and good user interface designed decision tree. You can do the same thing just by saying, you know, yes, no, and answering questions and going down and going through the decision tree, and it's helping you do something. So it's still not AI. For me, I think it was like a crime bot UK or something. Anyway, it was you were going to go in and it would ask you questions about a crime that or you've been a victim of a crime in the UK, and it was going to help direct you and give you answers about what the solution to your problem was. So I went in and I started asking it questions and it was dumb. It was so A, it couldn't spell things correct. And this was not like American to English. It was just like literally bad, you know. And then it also started insulting me. I was like, I started asking, you know, as soon as it got a little confused, I was like, well, I'm a man. And it was like, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. And I'm like, wait a minute. I don't need a sexist robot to start telling you like wait a minute, back off, man, you know. And so that went not well, and it kept going downhill.
They tried to give it personality, apparently.
Yes, you know. And then he got really obsessed about anuses for some reason. You know, it was like it asked you a lot of questions about your anus. And I'm not sure how it was coded. The person who did that, they were like really excited about some crimes involving and then it'll ask you about your anus a lot, but then if you respond to anus, it then berates you to say, don't use that language here. And it's like this is not replacing anyone anytime soon. This is awful. And that inspired a lot of other lawyers. Ken White, who runs Popat, did one. And I think some of the people at Fault Lines, which is the big criminal defense sort of network, they did it too.
They engaged with the same law bot.
Yes, everyone did the same thing, and the same thing happened every time. It's awful. And again, it gets obsessed with your anus. It berates you for your language. And God forbid you're a man, because it just feels really sorry for you.
Oh, well, so. I mean, I've got to thank you and all the others who took the time to engage with this thing. You're no doubt improving it and helping improve other people's experiences with it by publicizing the fact that it seems to have some issues. Maybe for the time being, it should only be handling virtual reality assault type questions.
Something, and it's lawbot.info. Sorry, my Slack channel is like getting onto me for not saying the name correctly. They're like, say lawbot. So it's lawbot.info.
Yes. Lawbot.info. Perfect. Before we leave the topic of things you talk to that may or may not be helpful, and move on to Slack, because I do want to explore that with you before we wrap up the show today. I guess back to the Super Bowl just for a moment, and the ads that are always everyone's second favorite part of the Super Bowl, if their first favorite part isn't the game itself or halftime. The Google ad that ran during the show actually managed to trigger lots of Google Home devices and have them talk back to the TV. So that's entertaining, but probably wasn't intended. Mike, any thoughts?
I was stunned to read this article. You would think that something like this would have been caught during the vetting process, that, you know, people are going to be watching this. They're going to have their devices there and it may automatically set them off. I just thought it was humorous and an interesting read for sure.
Yes. Humorous and interesting read should be the segue to our next little story, which we've talked about some more in-depth legal issues. This is a bit on the lighter side. Let's look at what I consider a patent issue. And we can keep discussing the Super Bowl while we do it. Because, again, you know, everyone's favorite part of the Super Bowl, either the ads or the halftime show. The halftime show this year was spectacular. We've already talked about the drones. But another thing that caught my eye during the halftime show, and I wonder, I mean, if you're a Star Wars fan, it probably caught your eye too, was the incredible circular keyboard that was on stage. Lead keyboardist Brockett Parsons invented the thing. It is circular. It has 294 keys, and he and his team of inventors have called it the Piano Arc or the Brockett Ship. It has three 88-node keyboards and 30 key control section. So if you are not Brockett Parsons, I think you're going to take some effort to get up to speed in how to play this thing. But the reason I throw it in under patent is, of course, I'm looking in IRC. Does everyone know where we're going with this? Yes, IRC, Zephyr, and others are talking about Max Rebo. I'm wondering if Lucasfilm has prior art on this thing. And I say that tongue-in-cheek. I don't know. You know, you never know who's going to assert their ownership in some sort of novel device. And this seems like something for the TMCA blog, Mike, where we're talking about fictional items and real world intellectual property concerns. What do you think? Could Lucasfilm take their fictional Max Rebo keyboard and assert that this guy can't get a patent on his rocket ship?
Well, I suppose this could count as prior art. If you can't create a real world Krusty Krab because Nickelodeon or Viacom owns the Krusty Krab rights in the to that name, you know, I suppose this could be patent prior art in terms of patent. Although I don't know. I mean, the Max Rebo that doesn't look nearly as sexy as the other 360-degree piano that we saw at the Super Bowl halftime show. I'm just saying.
You don't think? It's a little more steampunk, but it's still, I think it goes all the way around.
See that? Right. That's someone pointed out from Slack. That's from Eurovision 2014.
Oh, okay.
So somebody at least 3 years ago has had a big 360-degree keyboard, at least in Europe.
Uh-huh.
So maybe there's some international patent issue that they
wasn't
into.
The same guy?
I don't think so.
No. All right. We will continue monitoring the field of circular keyboards and
I want a rocket ship, so.
Yeah.
I personally want a rocket ship, so.
Christmas is long way away. Not too soon to start saving for you, Mike. I'm gonna start a little fund. All right. Let us get to my favorite bumper of the show. This fits nowhere except under interesting technologies or other. All right, Keith, you've referred repeatedly throughout the show to lawyer Slack. I've used Slack before. I've used it in the way sort of coordination between project coordination between people, you know, where you can put links and share and sort of a shared workspace kind of thing. How are you using it and what is lawyer Slack?
Sure. So Slack, you know, is the big sort of new hotness in terms of a communications platform for people. And most people use it in Teams and that sort of environment. But people are using it actually in a lot of ways as private, small scale social media. So I kind of got the heads up from a few different people down here in the Southeast in Atlanta. There's like a programmer / design IT group that's got about 15,000 people in it. That is just all, and people use it, and there's, you know, hundreds of channels, and people just discuss different things. But it's a little bit, you know, it's a private place to go have these conversations. So I started thinking about it, and I thought, you know, lawyers are online and on social media, and they have conversations. But a lot of times people are a little reluctant, especially lawyers, because of ethical constraints, privacy issues, you know, they're a little reserved about how they discuss things. So I thought, all right, well, how about if I started to create a place where lawyers could all go in and have these conversations that would be only for lawyers? And, you know, I would vet people, I would make them, you know, respond from a firm or organizational email address. They would need to show me where they are on their state bar, you know, website. You know, send me a copy, take a picture of their bar license. And I, you know, obviously everything could be fake, but, you know, I go through a pretty rigorous process of screening people to make sure they're lawyers and then add them all in there. And so, you know, at this point in time, it's nowhere near 15,000 people. Right now, it's about 250 lawyers from around mostly in the United States. There's some Canadians, a few Australians, a couple guys in Europe. Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, there's dozens of channels. People talk intellectual property. People talk criminal work. You know, there's domestic lawyers in there, criminal defense lawyers. There's a lot of in-house guys. There's a lot of West Coast in-house lawyers who all use Slack for, you know, their tech companies. I don't want to name names and out anybody, but companies everyone's very familiar with are in there. And they're already using Slack. So for them to suddenly have this outlet where, hey, we can hang out with a bunch of other lawyers and you know, address matters like, an outside vendor contract came in and how do we talk about that and et cetera, et cetera.
it's just a forum for that. And then also people, you know, talk their kids for sports or, you know, anything else that comes up and create. And then also it kind of creates its own little things. This past week, if you were on Twitter, there was a hashtag, Tiffany versus Twitter, Tiffany v. Twitter. It was about a San Diego law student that someone in the channel had discovered had filed a pro se complaint that was just insane. She sued her school, and there was a parody Twitter account of hers that nobody had ever heard of. And then, you know, she was a victim of the Streisand effect in that she filed a crazy pro se complaint and sued her school, San Diego School of Law, this fictional Twitter account and Twitter, and claimed $100 million in damages.
So there are many uses to lawyer slack: humor, venting, informational. I am, on the one hand, so glad that you have done this. And of course, you're going to invite Mike and me and Emery in, I hope, as soon as we get off the show. On the second hand, I am so... before I leave being glad, one of the reasons I'm so glad that you have done this is because there are so many people trying to get into the social network for lawyers vertical out there. And none of that, at least for me, has been useful or anything I want to be a part of. You know,
they all suck.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean,
to be blunt. Up,
yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, I've seen these come up and people have kind of pitched them to me. And my response has always been like, okay. And then mostly, people want you to pay for them. And that's what I think is stupid. You know, people are like, hey, we've come up with this cool social media platform for lawyers and we're going to charge you like $10 a month or $20 a month. And it's like, I can get all that for free off of Facebook with just a private group. Why is anyone going to give you money?
Or we're going to make it super formal, or we're going to make you rate each other like LinkedIn, or, you know, they try and import all this other sort of stuff that doesn't work well or doesn't lead to really free flowing, useful interactions from other social networks. And yeah, like you said, to put it bluntly, they suck. But this seems like it could be super useful and fun, and also in light of everything we've talked about today, terrifying. You're starting a social network.
Yeah, it's hey, you know, that's the thing with Slack. You know, a lot of people, especially the license I use is the free license, because if I actually had to pay for each one of these people, it would be thousands of dollars a month. Uh-huh. So I just use the free version, which limits you to the rolling most recent 10,000 messages. And so a lot of people, you know, initially are like, oh, well, those disappear. No, they don't. They are Slack archives every single message all the time, even if you're on the limited one. And then suddenly if you pay, then you can pay and they'll give you your back history. So if suddenly you start paying up, then it's like, oh, okay, every single message you've ever sent is suddenly available. So that is a thing, and I make that clear to everybody join and be like, look, you know, don't be sharing any crazy client confidential business here. You know, that's not the place for this. It's what social media was originally intended for. It's kind of a water cooler for lawyers to talk about what's going on in their day, and it's just a little bit better because it's away from prying eyes. Lawyers can let their hair down a little bit. They know everyone else is a lawyer. No crazy person's going to come in with a baseball bat, figuratively speaking, on Twitter and, you know, start making crazy arguments and interrupt. You know, it just raises the level of discussion a little bit. And people have really enjoyed it. It's great. I mean, we go through about 15,000 messages a week at this point. So,
well, I mean, you're going to get the wild cards in there, though. I mean, not every lawyer is a good person, as we've discussed. And simply making sure someone's a lawyer is not going to mean that it's always going to be civil and nice and useful in there. Do you have, you know, any sort of, other than saying don't disclose client confidentialities, are there any other strictures that you're putting on people?
Well, it definitely attracts, and maybe that's just a reflection of my own attitude, but it attracts a salty crowd. People are, to put it bluntly. Yeah. So
well, you said Mark Randaz is in there. So
yeah, Marco's in there. Yeah.
He's salt personified.
Yeah. So Mark sent me a text message. He was like, hey, put me in here. And I was like, sure. He's like, can I say beep? And I was like, yes, you can say beep. And he was like, beep, yeah. You know, it was Mark. And so, you got to be ready for that. People are just going to lay it down. Be out of that. The big rule is my rule that I think really suits well for these types of situations is, it's about 90%, 95% everyone uses has to use their real name, and I get to know everyone's real name.
There you go.
I let a few people stay anonymous because of their insensitive positions. Some of the GC people, they don't want to say what, they're like, I really want to be in there, but I can't say where I am. And I understand that. I let them remain anonymous. A couple other lawyers who are in sensitive positions, I let them stay anonymous. But mostly everyone's got their real name. And then, it's just be cool, don't spam,
This is your kingdom and you are a benevolent ruler.
Yeah, I try to be. There's at this point in time, it's been going for 8 or 9 months. And there's just a culture of it. The one or two times there have been problems with somebody, I've been gone and I come back and I've got a couple messages and people are like, so-and-so was a problem. We took care of it. And I'm like, oh, okay, sure.
That's awesome. I'm sure this is how Slashdot started someday.
Oh, yeah.
Long, long, long ago. That kind of thing. That's just wonderful. Let's see. We had a good comment from IRC. CRL says, you can identify the bad ones by their white shoes.
There you go. There's probably about a dozen big law guys in there. And, they don't lord it over everybody too much. They're the good big law people.
Yep. And those, they do exist. Our second pass race for the show is going to be, where's my lawyer Slack invite? And thanks for bringing us up to speed. I'm sure you might want to let people know where they can reach you, Keith, your preferred mode of contact in case Mike and I aren't the only ones who are itching to get in there.
Sure. Yeah. Right there. associatesmind.com. Hit me up on Twitter is probably the best. I do email, but Twitter's more immediate. And I said originally, people are like, oh, I want to get in, I'm a lawyer. There I'm like, okay, well, how do I know you're a lawyer? Well, my Twitter profile says I'm a lawyer. I'm like, that doesn't count, there'll have to be a couple emails back and forth to determine, make sure that you're a lawyer and everything. So once that's done, we'll get you in there.
In other words, Keith, there's extreme vetting.
Extreme vetting. There are some extreme vetting to get into lawyer Slack. We've got a wall, let's be clear. And it's and we don't have time for any type of alternative facts that you want to bring into lawyer Slack. Real facts.
Okay.
Extreme vetting.
All right. Who's paying for the wall?
You are, who is not inside.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And thank you for being with us, Keith. We've got a resource and a tip for you. And also, before we go, one of our favorite parts of the show, our animal selfie of the week. It's a quick and easy animal selfie. We do these each week in honor of the ways in which copyrights and various other rights are asserted, interestingly, on behalf of animals and sometimes other more inanimate devices in our legal world. We were covering so many of those stories on the show that we decided to just go ahead and throw an animal selfie into every show. This week's features a doggy. And Star Wars, and I believe the doggy's name is Wampa because the doggy's caption is Wampa took a selfie with the Wampa. So we have not only Max Rebo and his keyboard in the show, but also two Wampas for you this week. Our tip of the week, I'm just going to do one, I think, since we're getting a little pressed for time. Our tip of the week would be pay your $7. This comes courtesy of Sean Spicer, who you may or may not have seen had not paid his $7 to, I believe, I don't know if it was GoDaddy or who else his registrar was, but his Whois information was freely available and had not only personal information about him, which has to be associated, you know, you have to fork this over when you register a domain name, but various other domains he had registered, including one that was selling Republican elephant trunked ties. And so Mr. Spicer was much speculation ensued about the competition between the Trump tie line and the Spicer tie line, and just the fact that his personal information was out there and hadn't been concealed by that easy additional payment to your registrar is something that reached national and even international attention this week. So thank you, Sean, for reminding us all to pay our $7 if we have not yet done so. And a couple of resources of the week for you. One is Jennifer Gronick's new book. It is called, as it loads, American Spies, Modern Surveillance, Why You Should Care and What to Do About It. It came out last month, and it is a good follow-up to our discussions last week and the week before and our ongoing discussions about surveillance and privacy and security. Jennifer Gronick's been on the show before, and I haven't read her book yet, but it is on my list and it should be on yours. Also, something you might want to put on your list is Keith's book, The Marble and the Sculpture, From Law School to Law Practice. I'm sure our absent co-host, Emery, would like to read this. So I'm putting it on my Christmas list for him. Mike, you get the keyboard. Emery gets the book. you two could share the two.
There you go.
There we go. Do you want to tell us what prompted you to write this, Keith?
Well, I was minding my own business, and then the ABA called me up, and they were like, have you ever thought about writing a book? And I was like, of course I've thought about writing a book. And, they were like, do you want to do it for us? And I was like, sure, why not? And then we, kind of got into it, but then I had to kind of drag them kicking and screaming into the 21st century. Cause I had to explain, until my book, the ABA, they sold books via the ABA web store, which I can see you right now going, what's the ABA web store? You know, it's like, and so I was like, there's this place online where people buy books. It's called Amazon. You might have heard of it. And we had to go through that process that, you know, Amazon was a place where people buy books now.
Yes.
And that's where the ABA should sell their books, which that was difficult. And that took 6 months to take care of before we actually got to making the book be a thing, but it did. Mm-hmm. So they just came out. I think they had done a survey of the Young Lawyer Division and asked them where they read their news and where they got news online. And I think, you know, mm-hmm. the ABA was secretly hoping it was going to be like the ABA Journal or something. It was not.
No.
It was above the law and a couple other places. And then I was like fourth or fifth on the list with Associates Mind. And so they reached out to me and said, hey, you know, a lot of our YLD members read your site. We think you'd be a good person as a good fit to write about what it's like to be a new lawyer right now, because they had had plenty of other books about what it's like to be a new lawyer, but they were all written by like really old white dudes from 30 years ago.
And, wearing white shoes.
Wearing white shoes, and the legal market, you know, is forever changed post 2007. So they were at least cognizant of the fact that he needed to reach out to somebody who was, you know, fresh to have a different perspective. So they did, and got it done. It took about a year and a half. So, and I think it came out in 2013. So it's been 4 years now.
The entire legal profession owes you such a debt of gratitude, Keith. You're getting lawyer books on Amazon. You're improving law chatbots. And and you're setting up a useful social network for lawyers that is not,
doing
that
my
does
best.
Not suck. Yes. So thank you on behalf of the profession. And thank you so much for joining us today. It's really been fun chatting with you.
Absolutely.
Anything else? We've already plugged your book. We've plugged your website. Anything else we should plug or anything else you want to let people know about before we get on out of here?
I'm trying to think off the top of my head.
now we talk Slack, talk Twitter, talk mm-hmm. website. Support. Here, see my t-shirt?
Yes. What does your t-shirt say, though?
The content of this shirt is no longer available due to a copyright claim.
There we go.
that's from Mike and the guys over at TechDirt who are being sued right now because they said there's this guy who said, I invented email, and he's a liar because he did not invite email, and he's suing them for like a ton of money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously they've got their, you know, truth is absolute defense to defamation. And this guy, you know, has very kind of fanciful claims about email. And so anyway, they're getting hit with a huge lawsuit and they've got lots of legal bills. And TechDirt is kind of this long running, the whole Streisand effect I talked about earlier. Mike's the guy who came up with the term years ago. And you know, they're a long running site, but they're about to have a lot of legal bills and to fight for the First Amendment. And I don't think they're raising any money. The one thing they're doing is they're still selling these shirts, and they came out with a new shirt today that says "I invented email."
So oh, that's awesome!
If you want to support the First Amendment, go buy a shirt from the guys at TechDirt, and you know, you'll be helping out. Instead of going to the ACLU, they got tons of money. Don't worry about them now. Go buy a t-shirt, and you'll help out the First Amendment.
That's a great.
They need a TechDirt. What was it? The TechDirt
a
button?
Dash button. They need a dash button.
There we go.
Yes. So
yes, there you go.
Somebody. Yes. Wonderful. Yeah, I'm definitely going to head on over there and survey the shirt landscape after the show. Thank you so much for mentioning that. And thank you so much for joining us. We'll hopefully have you back on the show at some point in the future and see what new things you've been doing to improve the profession and the world. We look forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it.
Mike, great hanging out with you again as well. Anything new in Seattle other than flurry of legal activity?
Lots of flurries of snow this past week. I do want to mention one thing for all of our people in the Seattle area. On Thursday at 4:30, we are hosting an event at Dorsey & Whitney in Seattle. We're going to have a screening of a relatively new documentary called Other People's Footage, Copyright and Fair Use. It's an excellent film that talks about the legal implications of using other people's content in documentaries, full feature films, and other things. It's going to be great. We have a great panel of experts that will be joining us, and then we're going to have a reception too. So if anybody's interested in attending, you can reach out to me on Twitter or via email, and we'd love to get you signed up.
No web link where people can go for more info?
You can go to the Copyright Society of the U.S. website. It's csusa.org, and you can sign up that way too.
Excellent. Thank you, Mike. Really enjoyed the show.
Thank you. That was a blast. Thanks a lot, Keith, for being with us today.
Yes.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And thank you to all of you who have either joined us live or are tuning in after we recorded the show. We record these shows every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1900 UTC. If you head on over to twit.tv/live at that time, you will find us doing our thing every Friday. But don't worry about it. If you can't, you can go over to twit.tv/twill instead. And there you'll find our entire archive of shows. There's one there every week going back for a long, long time. And all the way back to when we started the show in 2006. So I hope you'll enjoy rummaging around in the archive, finding our wonderful guests. We always are so blessed to have such great people like Keith today come join us and spend their time and their thoughts and insights with us. If you have ideas for other such people that we should invite on the show, or you just want to talk about things we brought up or have questions, whatever, email us. Mike is Mike at twit.tv. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Emery, who hopefully will be back next week, is Emery at twit.tv. You can find us all on Twitter as well. The show has a Facebook page. And I know it every time I say this, more and more people sort of snicker at me, but it has still a Google Plus page. It's not very active, but I'm still keeping it up. I don't know how long I'll continue to do that, but there is a Google Plus page over there. Probably more likely that you're going to find the show's Facebook page. Good place to, again, if you have something longer than will fit in a tweet and you want to do it publicly and not an email, that would be where I suggest you go to do it. We highlight. We use that page too, as well as Twitter, to sort of let you know what we're thinking about as we run up to the show. I try and always post our rundown in process and update our Flipboard magazine for people who subscribe to that. So to let you guys know what we're thinking about for the show. And of course, if you would like to contribute to our Flipboard magazine, we've had to weed out a couple of, speaking of, you know, maintaining your social network and keeping track of who's involved in your collaboration space. We've had to weed out a couple of people from Flipboard who were posting really strange or really inappropriate things. But by and large, our Flipboard contributors are great. And if you want to be one, just shoot me a note and I'll be happy to invite you in there and see how it goes. I'm not doing any extreme vetting. We're doing extreme vetting after the fact for that one. So see how that process works. Anyway, we will be back next week and we hope to see you then. Until then, take care.